All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good evening and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I have the privilege of being your host today on Veterans Radio. We've got a great program here beginning off the year, and I know that my partner last week had Rebecca Grant on, and she was talking all about the potential dangers in the world over the next couple of months and probably years. And we are very concerned about what's going to be happening there, and we got a president-elect that's coming into being starting next Friday, so we just wish him the best of luck and let him know that we are watching and we want to make sure that he keeps all of his promises. So there, that's the end of that. There are 25 million veterans out there, and we want to make sure that everybody is watching and paying attention to what's going on. He has promised many things. I hope he can come through on some of them or all of them, and maybe things will turn out better. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I hope so. Anyway, today on the program, we are going to be talking with a friend of ours, Bill Reeder, and Bill Reeder's got a book about his adventures in Vietnam. He was a Cobra pilot there and unfortunately was shot down, and the story goes on from there. And so he's going to be on in just a little bit. But starting off the program, we're going to be talking with a young woman who is from an organization called the EOD Warrior Foundation. And everything is disappearing on what I thought I had in front of me. But joining me on the line right now is Nicole Motzik. And Nicole, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it is my pleasure. So tell me about the EOD Warrior Foundation.
Absolutely. So EOD is Explosive Ordnance Disposal, which is basically the military's bomb squad. It runs across all four branches of service, and all four branches of service, officers and enlisted, go to school at the same school, go through school together. Okay. And these men and women are truly doing one of the most dangerous jobs in the military. They are, you know, running towards danger, disarming devices, rendering safe devices, clearing minefields while everyone else is clearing out and running away. And the foundation supports those warriors and their families.
I can certainly relate to the running away. We have had a number of EOD people on Veterans Radio over the last 13 years, and some of them, you know, just we've had women, and some of them were very small people, some of them were very large people, and I just couldn't understand how they could stay so calm doing their job. Were you one of them?
I was not. Actually, my husband was Army EOD, and okay. My father-in-law also was Army EOD. So it's personal to me. You know, we have friends who've been wounded, friends who have been killed, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And luckily, my husband, after two deployments, came home, you know, safe both times. But it is very personal to us. And I just couldn't ask for a better job and a better opportunity to support this nation's bravest.
I can hardly breathe when I think about what they do. So let's talk about the EOD Warrior Foundation and what you do to not only help these men and women that are coming back, but there are other parts of your organization as well.
True. We have four pillars of support. One of those is financial relief, and a portion of that is often emergency financial relief for families, you know, when someone is injured or someone is killed. Other EOD warriors find themselves down the line with any number of financial struggles many times because they're struggling with post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury and just trying to wrap their arms around that and move forward in life. So financial relief is one of our pillars. Hope and wellness is another. So we truly embrace the community in a proactive sense and try and put together retreats and wellness events so that we can make sure that we're connecting with these families and serving them, trying to help make sure that we're exposing them and you know, offering them some of the best services that are out there as not only individual warriors or caregivers or widows, but also as families and as couples. And the third pillar of support is scholarships. So we offer, last year we had just over $200,000 in scholarships to EOD dependents. And then the fourth is maintaining the EOD Memorial Wall, which is at Eglin Air Force Base right across the street from the schoolhouse.
Wow, that's a lot. How long have you been in existence?
Well, the EOD Memorial Foundation originally started in 1969. And so they set up an EOD Memorial and a scholarship program. And then in 2007, at the peak of the war in the Middle East, the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation stood up. I mean, we literally had EOD Warriors, amputees that were coming back sometimes twice a week to Walter Reed and Balboa. And so that the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation stood up at that time. In 2013, the organizations came together and merged to become the EOD Warrior Foundation to really make sure that we had the capacity to serve these brave men and women and their families and the community at large.
Okay. And so you put all kinds of, on all kinds of different programs throughout the year. Is that correct?
Correct. Both, we have fundraisers that people host on our behalf across the country, and then we have retreats, one, two, often a month, across the country as well for our men and women.
Okay. We are talking about the EOD Warrior Foundation here with its executive director, Nicole Motzek. And what's coming up next? Anything in any part of the country? Our listeners are all over the place.
Yeah, we have lots of things. You can, if you go on our website to EODWarriorFoundation.com/events, you can see all the events that are coming up. Some of our big events, we have a Warriors Helping Warriors event, which is in Paso Robles, April 8th, and that is actually a retired Navy EOD warrior, Leon Tackett, has a winery out there called Tackett Family Vineyards, and every year he gets all of the community, both EOD community and local Paso Robles, California community, together to bottle wine, and it's a huge fundraiser for us, raising over $30,000 last year. So that's an amazing day that's open to everyone and super fun. The Memorial Day weekend, we have another a run in San Diego. And then in February, actually January, we have a plunge in Wyoming. And then in February, we have two more polar bear plunges, or a polar bear and a penguin plunge. One is in Destin, Florida, and one is in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Okay. I'm looking at the website. The website is EODWarriorFoundation.org, and you just go up there and click on events. And they have some very unusual people who are going to look like they're going to be jumping in very cold water.
Yes, there's always a costume contest, which is often the entertainment of the day.
I can only imagine. I'll have to look at the photographs when I get a chance to. And then you've got, what is your big event for the year? Is it the wine tasting, or is it something bigger than that?
The main event for the foundation is the EOD weekend, which happens in Florida. And that weekend, the most important event is the EOD Memorial Ceremony. So we have 321 EOD warriors on the EOD Memorial Wall right now, and this year we will be adding six more, two of which were killed in the last year in action. And then other ones that are from World War II and Vietnam, who our EOD historians in the community continue to research and make sure that if someone is deserving of being on the wall, that they are rightfully placed there. So the first weekend in May every year is the EOD Memorial Ceremony, and around that we also have an EOD auction on Friday night. Saturday morning is the memorial ceremony, and then Saturday evening is an EOD ball. So that's really our big weekend where the community comes together, remembering our fallen, honoring our wounded, you know, just coming together and enjoying one another as well.
Okay, and so the EOD memorial, that's on, looks like it's Friday, starts Friday on May 5th, and this is down this is in Pensacola, Florida, correct?
It's in Fort Walton Beach, Florida.
Fort Walton Beach, okay, excuse me, Eglin. That's right.
Yes. Exactly.
All right. I got them. They're all along there. It's, you know, I was at Fort Rucker in Alabama, and we used to come down there every once in a while to get to the ocean.
Right. Also a close hop to get to the ocean. That's right.
That is very true. Well, Nicole, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio today and talking about the EOD Warrior Foundation. The website is EODWarriorFoundation.org. There's lots of great information on there, and we strongly suggest our audience go down and check it out. Maybe you can help out. Maybe you can make a donation. Maybe you can go to some of these events. I challenge you guys to go in on those plunges just as well.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much, Dale. Thanks for having us on, and thanks to your listeners for hearing about the foundation. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I hope to have you back on again.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
You too. Thank you. All right. That was the EOD. These are explosive ordnance disposal people, the men and women that go out there and explode these things before they blow up around people. I was trying to remember a program that we did almost when we began about 10 years ago, where we had a young Marine corporal, I believe she was, and that was her job. And she was only about 5 feet tall. Not that size has anything to do with it, but it was just so amazing that these stereotypes that we have for these big, you know, burly people going out and disposing of all these bombs, just, pardon the pun, blown apart there. But anyway, all right, we are going to be taking a real quick break, and we'll be back with William Reeder, and we're going to be talking about his experiences in Vietnam as a Cobra pilot and then, unfortunately, as a POW. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We will be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are going to be talking with William Reeder Jr. here in just a second about his book called Through the Valley, His Captivity in Vietnam. I want to remind you that you can contact us on the air here on Veterans Radio. That's the local number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. You can follow us on Facebook. I think you can follow us on Twitter. We're working on that. And we have other ways that you can get a hold of us if you would like. I was fascinated by the story of William Reeder. We had him on earlier last year to just talk about this book just a little bit. But I finally got the opportunity to read the book all the way through. And so I want to welcome William Reeder to Veterans Radio and say Happy New Year, William.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
This was one of those books that once I started reading it, I could not put it down. It was so, anxiety-ridden, I guess would be the word, for me and probably for so many other people that were involved in the military and during the Vietnam era. You were, and this was your second tour, no less.
Yeah, it was. I had a first tour of duty flying fixed-wing reconnaissance airplanes, in which I managed to get shot down then, too, over the middle of Laos on a classified mission.
Were you a, I got an email this morning from a friend of yours. Were you a cat killer?
No, but I know the Cat Killers. Now, the Cat Killers were a small reconnaissance airplane company flying L-19 Bird Dogs, O-1
right,
Bird Dogs,
right.
Right next to us on my first tour of duty, and some of my flight school classmates ended up in that unit as well.
Okay. So when were you there flying in the Mohawk?
1968-1969, and that was right out of flight school. Finished, and in those days, the Army had two flight schools, fixed-wing and rotary-wing flight
right.
school. I went to fixed-wing flight school and then directly into the Mohawk qualification after flight school and then right over on my first tour of duty in Vietnam.
And where were you at, in I Corps? You were in I Corps both times.
I was in I Corps the first time, and
mm-hmm.
I was up at Wei Phu Bai in the... just north of Da Nang, south of the demilitarized zone, flying
okay.
Mohawks. I will say that Mohawk unit was a special mission Mohawk unit, and the only time that we saw South Vietnam was on takeoffs and landings. All of our missions launched and went out of country.
Oh, I'm familiar with that. You went over there.
we did. There were five Mohawk companies in Vietnam, one for each of the core tactical zones in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And then ours was a special mission unit, and all of our missions were tasked out of country into Laos and North Vietnam, and I had one very special mission into Cambodia as well.
Okay, yeah. My unit was assigned to work with Command and Control South, and so we spent a lot of time, as they called it, over the fence as well.
Okay, well, we've got some stories to share there, too, because as you saw in the book, my second tour of duty flying Cobras was in support of Command and Control Central, which
right.
is also those Special Forces special missions. Yeah.
Which is what got me all tangled up inside of your book, going, oh, by the grace of God, that could have been me. And but, all right, so let's get right into this. I got to tell our audience, I said, you know, this is just not an everyday pilot here. Do you mind if I call you Bill?
No, please
okay.
do.
Bill is a retired Army colonel, no less. He was a real live officer, highly decorated combat veteran of Vietnam, received a Silver Star for gallantry, two Distinguished Flying Crosses, Air Medal with V, three Purple Hearts. A lot of stuff. You did a lot of unusual things, and at least some people saw some of it, looks like.
Well, you know, like so many of us, in Army Aviation. I was a young guy just looking to looking for a lot of action, and I sure found it.
That's true. That's true. I think we were a little... Well, that's why they have 20-year-olds do that stuff initially.
That's right, yeah.
All right. So let's talk about what happened to you on that day when you took off in your Cobra, and you didn't come back on that Cobra.
No, I didn't. And, you know, ironically, I thought that I'd miss the war, at least on the second tour. It's hard to think back on Vietnam now and remember, but we thought the war was over and that we had won at the end of 1971. It was all being turned over to the Vietnamese, and we were withdrawing U.S. forces. And so I went back over thinking I wouldn't see much action, when indeed, in fact, there were no American ground forces left in the part of Vietnam I went back to, just some Army aviation units and a few special forces guys. But we found ourselves very soon after the turn of the new year into 1972 in the middle of the biggest enemy offensive of the war, the Easter Offensive of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
In one of those missions, I got launched out on the morning of the 9th of May to support an American, or wasn't an American, a Vietnamese Ranger base. It had been an American Special Forces base at Ben Het, right near the borders of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, that was under attack by elements of two North Vietnamese divisions. So there were thousands of enemy soldiers, and there were tanks involved in this battle, too. So a number of tanks in the battle, a lot of artillery shooting at the base. On that base were probably about 500 or 600 South Vietnamese and indigenous mountain yards, making up two Vietnamese Ranger battalions, and with them they had two American advisors.
Let's kind of give a little history lesson to our audience here. As you mentioned, by 72, there were really no ground troops, American ground troops on the ground, but there were an awful lot of aviation units over there. And one of my understandings is that as far as the casualties were concerned for pilots and crew chiefs and so forth, is that they went up dramatically during that time period, because you were providing support for the South Vietnamese troops, and normally there were one or two advisors that were still on the ground with them, and the North Vietnamese saw this as an opportunity to start their push toward Saigon.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and they built their forces up across the border inside of Laos and Cambodia, and launched this major three-pronged offensive, first across the demilitarized zone in the border between North Vietnam and South Vietnam, then out of Cambodia towards Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and then lastly out of Laos and Cambodia into the Central Highlands where I was, in an attempt to cut South Vietnam in half.
Wow. All right. So what was the unit? You were part of the Pink Panthers?
I was. The 361st Aerial Weapons Company, or Aviation Company Air Escort, that carried both those names during the war, Pink Panthers. Mm-hmm. Our mission when I arrived was almost exclusively support of special forces that MACV SOG, mm-hmm. with their special missions, and we had some cross-border operations in support of those guys into Laos. But yeah, once that offensive started, our mission became part of the fire brigade to support anybody and everybody that came under attack inside of South Vietnam during that offensive.
Well, a lot of our listeners are Vietnam veterans, and many of them got to, you know, fly on Hueys and so forth. And the Cobra was coming into play just as I was getting ready to leave Vietnam. I was there in 68 and 69 as well. And our gun platoons flew Charlie model Hueys. Could you describe to our audience a little bit about what the capabilities of a Cobra was?
Yeah, the Cobra really evolved out of the Huey, the armed Hueys, the Charlie model Huey, and the Cobra was designed specifically and purely as an attack helicopter. So it was a two-crew aircraft, pilot and co-pilot gunner. The pilot sat in the back seat, co-pilot gunner in the front seat. The aircraft was very thin. It was only like 36 inches wide, and it was armed with rockets, 2.75 rockets on the wing stores. Had a movable turret that the front seat co-pilot gunner operated, and that turret was any combination of minigun and or 40-millimeter grenade launcher. It was a very effective and devastating weapon. Some of the birds also mounted a 20-millimeter Gatling gun cannon on the wing. So it was an awesome attack helicopter, awesome machine.
I know the first time I saw it. I just went, this can't be good for the bad guys. This is not good for the bad guys. All right, so let's talk about what happened. You know, the Easter Offensive started, and I'm sure that you were in the book, you talk about, you know, many, many flight hours that you were getting in support of the various teams that were out there and the fire bases that unfortunately were starting to be overrun. So what happened? What happened on your day taking off out of Ben Het?
Yeah, that was the question you asked before I get into a little bit of the context of history. Yeah, I was launched out first thing that morning on a tactical emergency mission because Ben Het was under attack, as I described, with elements of two NVA divisions, and they only had the two Vietnamese Ranger battalions with two American advisors on the ground. I launched out leading a flight of Cobras to lend support. We also had in tow a special... and the details are in the book, so I won't spend a whole bunch of time with it. It was a special, at the time, classified UH-1 Huey with a new missile system on board. It's old hat now. That was the first prototype of the TOW missile system.
Oh, okay.
As it was used in combat that day. Yeah, we did three total turns in combat that morning. On the third one, we were asked to escort a Huey ammunition resupply helicopter into Ben Het. By that point, the base had been completely overrun except for the command bunker complex at the center and top of their hillside there. There was enemy all over the base, tanks inside the wire. They were nearly out of ammunition. They were completely out of anti-tank ammunition. So we were asked to escort the Huey resupply helicopter in. The weather was deteriorating with a ceiling or a solid layer of clouds below 1,000 feet above the ground. So we came in screaming in high speed on the treetops to stay as low as we could and hopefully minimize fire to anti-aircraft weapons. They had anti-aircraft from 51 caliber machine guns up to 23 millimeter anti-aircraft weapons there.
Wow.
We did get the Huey in and out. The Huey did not take a hit. I was the lead Cobra in our turn outbound. We started taking hits from multiple anti-aircraft positions, and my wingman was also taking hits at the same time, and the pilot was badly wounded, Steve Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And then our aircraft essentially came down spinning and burning. I lost tail rotor. There were rounds through the engine, through the fuel cell, through the cockpit. We came down spinning and burning, impacted nose low on the left side. I tried to do an auto rotation. I'm afraid it was little more than a partially controlled crash under the circumstances.
Yeah. When you lose your tail rotor, you have a tendency to spin a lot.
You do. So we bounced up, did about another spin and a half, and settled in, and that was the shoot down.
All right, so now you're on the ground. Were you captive right away?
No. In fact, it was an unusual circumstance. I spoke with my front seater on the intercom after we impacted, and said, let's get out of this thing. They were a little different words than that, but it's good enough for the radio.
That will work. You don't have to clean it up too much.
and so I got out, and he got out. We get out different sides on the Cobra. The cockpit, one cockpit opens left, one opens right. I remembered I had some difficulty getting out of the cockpit, but and then don't remember much other than coming to, regaining consciousness some distance from the helicopter, and not being able to move.
I'm going to ask you to back up for a second, because as you were coming out of the helicopter, your helicopter was upside down.
No, the helicopter was right side up.
You were upside down.
I was having trouble getting out. My feet hung up on something.
Okay.
Mic cord, strap, something in the cockpit, and I remember difficulty getting out and hanging head down for a time. And then again, the next thing I remember is I regained consciousness some distance from the aircraft.
We'll come back to the hanging head down later on,
okay.
If you don't mind. All right. So was anybody sent out to pick you guys up, or you know, Jolly Green or anything like that?
Yeah, no. There was a gentleman who was the senior commander in the two corps in the area I was, named John Paul Van. There's an interesting book about him called Bright Shining Lie by Neil Sheehan. They also made a copy out of that.
Heard of that one? Okay.
But anyway, John Paul Van put out an edict that there would be no rescue attempt. one of the few times in American history, but he just saw that the situation was too dire. There was too much enemy activity, and that we'd probably just lose more people and lose more aircraft. I really don't have any hard feelings with him about that. I think it probably was a good decision. He was later killed in a flight in Vietnam, so he died over there. The guys on the ground did try to push out a team to get to me out of Ben Het. In the midst of all their being overrun, enemy tanks all over, they tried to push a team out. The team got some distance, didn't get all the way to me, took some casualties, and then had to recover back into the base. So that was the attempt to get me. Now, our unit went ahead and launched on what they advertised as just an armed reconnaissance later that afternoon with some guys from B Troop 717th Cav. And indeed, it was their own self-generated rescue attempt, not sanctioned by the command. They did get out to the crash site right at dusk, just as it was getting dark. And as I was, and later I regained the ability to move and crawl, and I was moving some distance away from the helicopter.
Okay, the music is coming up, and
yeah,
so we're
going to have to take a break. So we'll pick it up with that.
That's right.
I'm trying to get away from the helicopter, and there's other helicopters in the area. Go ahead.
All kinds of things. All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Bill Reeder. His book is Through the Valley, My Captivity in Vietnam. We'll be back after the news.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio, and we are talking to sky pilots, a lot of sky pilots today. We're talking with Bill Reeder, Jr., William Reeder, Jr. His book is Through the Valley, My Captivity in Vietnam. He was a Cobra pilot who was shot down. But first, Bill, before we get back to your book, we have a call on the line that somebody would like to say hello to you.
Okay.
So bring him on. All right. Charlie, you there?
Yep, I'm here. Hey, Bill. How are you doing?
Charles, I recognize your voice already. How you doing?
Oh, good. As soon as you came on the radio, Nancy said, Dale's voice still sounds the same. And I said, well, Bill's voice still sounds the same.
Oh, it's great to hear from you. Charles was one of those, I told you, he's a flight school classmate of mine and indeed a very good and dear friend even in those flight school days. And then he went over to the Cat Killers next to us at Wei Fu Bai while I was flying Mohawks. He was out there flying even lower and slower in those 01 bird dogs. It's great to hear from you, Charles.
Thanks, Bill. Dale, the only thing I really wanted to say was that we've distributed a lot of Bill's books and gotten people to buy them. It's a great read for anybody, whether they're an aviator or not, of how he survived.
It is.
Bill was a star in flight school. The only thing that most of us regret was, sorry for the dog, that we regret was that... he never got promoted to general. He was Aviator of the Year. His picture's at the Hall of Fame at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And he's very, very humble. He won't tell you all this stuff. But he was top honor graduate in flight school. But, got to know a lot of his friends that flew with him in the Mohawks and everything. And just his escape when he got shot down in the Mohawk was amazing. But the book... it took him a long time to do. Ask him why he took it so long to write it, and I'll hang up and listen to you.
Okay. Well, Charlie, I want to thank you very much. Just for our audience here, Charlie is married to a young lady that I went to high school with. So that's kind of the connection there. That's Nancy. Hi, Nancy. And
she's trying to shut the dog up.
Okay.
She says hi.
And
I'll hang up and listen. But great show, Dale.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You
all right, you guys.
So that was wonderful.
That was my surprise this morning when I woke up to an email from Nancy saying that Charlie wanted to call in. We had Charlie on our program a number of years ago with his own book about his experiences in 01, which is, you know, like flying a glider or something. It's so slow Joe Galloway tells us that all the pilots that were over there, especially the helicopter pilots, were all, you know, God's own lunatics.
And I would not disagree with that.
And the more I read these stories and the more I think about even just the little stuff that I did, I have to agree 100% there. So why did it take you so long to write this book?
There's a bunch of reasons. I'm not sure why Charles set me up with that, but he is too humble. I think I was the honor graduate of flight school, but he was right there with me. The two of us competed all the way through. We were good friends, but we competed every foot of the way. And his book was 100 Feet Over Hell about his bird dog operation.
Okay.
It took me so long because I think, first of all, I was just busy. I continued on active duty. I did not get out with a disability, so serving active duty officer, I was busy. Secondly, I did not really want to tell a story about myself. Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell this story badly. It was about the prisoners in South Vietnam, the southern prisoners. It was a different story than the more broadly known story of the POWs in Vietnam. That's usually told by the guys who were shot down and captured in the north. Ours was a totally different experience in the south. So I wanted to tell that, but I didn't want it to be focused on me. So I started out writing a historical novel. Everything in it was going to be true, but it was going to be told through about a half a dozen fictional characters. I got about five chapters scratched out and was coming along very slowly because I just didn't have a lot of time. When I came to the acquaintance of another published author named Joe Galloway,
mm-hmm.
Joe was kind enough to give me some encouragement and asked that I send what I had written to him and he would be happy to review it. I did. His response to me very politely stated after some time was essentially, "Hey, son, I see what you're trying to do, but, novels are tough. Why don't you just tell your story like I did?" That deflated my ego, but I think gave me a little bit of reality. I later got a repeat of that years later from another published author named Robert Mason, who wrote a book called Chicken Hawk,
with Patricia.
Yeah, Bob became a very good friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
and he encouraged me to write. And so I proudly said, "Well, I've written some stuff." He said, "Well, let me see it." And I sent almost the same chapters. I dusted them off, sent them to him. He came back with about the same comments that Joe Galloway did. And that put me face-to-face with reality, and I sat down, it's been about 5 years ago now, to pen the book as you see it today, which is a story about me, but I tried to make it more than just a, boasting my adventures in combat. I tried to make it a true, real tale of what happened, what it was like to be in combat, what it was like to be a prisoner of war, particularly in that southern environment and the journey north. And then I did bring out some of the highlights of the stories of others mm-hmm. who I encountered in my time as a prisoner of war, who indeed that chapter I titled In the Company of Heroes. But I endured a lot, but I was less than a year as a prisoner of war. There were guys 5, 7, one guy 9 years as a prisoner who endured so much more than me, and I bring out some of those stories in the book as well.
You do. You really do, Bill. And we're talking with Bill Reeder Jr., whose book is Through the Valley of My Captivity in Vietnam, and we kind of got off track a little bit. The circumstances and the situations that you went through as a POW in South Vietnam, working your way up to North Vietnam, I've talked with some other people that have had similar experiences, but you do bring out other people and you talk about them. And let's tell our audience, once you got out of your helicopter, and the thing we were going to talk about is you almost got shot even before you got out.
Oh, I did. So I mentioned that our unit and the B Troop 717th Cav launched their own rescue in spite of the fact they were ordered not to. Got out there that evening. And I heard the sound of rotor blades, and there was no doubt in my mind that they were going down to pick up my front seater.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard the sound of a little bird scout helicopter go to the ground and come back up, so I was certain that my front seat had been rescued. The pilot that did that out of B Troop was Jim Stein, Just the most extraordinary. You know, scout helicopter pilots are crazy people.
Crazier.
Anyway,
they're crazy.
Jim Stein is the wildest, craziest scout helicopter pilot that I ever knew. But he did some tremendous things, and he picked up my front seater. However, they could not get to me. And in my attempt to flash a strobe light to get rescued, that was taken by the lead Cobra as enemy fire. And I was shot at with the minigun from the front seat of that lead Cobra.
Well, that's the one time that you're glad that he wasn't an excellent shot.
It was awfully close, I'll tell you. I don't know how I'd say about 2 feet. I don't know, but it was close, yeah. But luckily, he did not hit me.
Well, you were trying to evade, and you had broken some bones in your back. You had done some serious damage to your leg. And how far did you think you could get?
Well, I figured I had to get about 40 miles away. At first, I looked at maybe trying to get up to the survivors of that fire base. But to do that, I'd had to get through cleared area that had been cleared by Agent Orange or Rome plows or something, through concertina wires, over minefields, through the attacking enemy, and have them not shoot me, and at the same time have the friendlies not think that I was an enemy and shoot me. So I didn't think that would work. My plan then was to go the opposite direction, 40 miles back to a friendly base. I thought, even with my condition of broken back, wounded ankle, burns in the back of my neck, superficial wounds on my head and face, that I could make it in a couple weeks. I did successfully evade the enemy for 3 days, which each contains its own small adventure, as detailed in the book.
Right.
But yeah, on the third day, my luck ran out, and I got captured.
Okay. Now, this is, you mentioned earlier about the idea that we have this typical idea of what happened to the POWs. You know, they were put in a Hanoi Hilton and so forth. Well, you were not put in a Hanoi Hilton.
No.
Could you describe where you went to first?
Yeah, I was captured on the battlefield and taken to an enemy staging area, interrogated for 3 days, and then marched south and then west, ended up in northern Cambodia in a jungle prison. It was maybe surprisingly, rather stereotypical of what you see what you think of with jungle cages. It was cages of bamboo. The cage I was in was about 12 feet wide, 20 feet long, but it was only about 4.5 feet high, so I couldn't stand up. It just all crouched down. I was slammed in there with, there were a couple dozen other prisoners, 20 prisoners or so in there, and our feet were kept in a wooden stock. It was a log down the center of the cage that was split longitudinally and then had holes cut big enough for ankles and the top put back down, and that's how we lived. I sat in a wooden cage with a bunch of other prisoners crammed in there with our feet in wooden stocks. Almost everyone wounded, suffering from malnutrition, disease, and people dying on a regular basis.
I don't even want to make you talk about some of these things, but I think our audience needs to understand. What was your diet initially?
I got about mid-morning. They brought a grapefruit-sized ball of rice, and then about mid-afternoon, they brought another grapefruit-sized ball of rice. In addition to that, we got water in a bamboo tube to drink during the day. That was my diet in that camp.
And in addition to your broken back, your open wounds, and so on and so forth, you probably ended up with dysentery, right?
I did. Got bloody dysentery. Had leeches all over me. Had three kinds of intestinal parasites, three kinds of malaria, one of them very often fatal. And then my ankle wound got very infected, and I think I was close to losing my leg and probably my life with the infection.
How did you survive that? I know that there's a couple of people that I want you to mention that you may want to mention.
Yeah, three people really. There was one other American prisoner with me in that camp. That whole camp had a lot of those bamboo cages that I described. Mm-hmm. There were about 300 prisoners. All of them were South Vietnamese and indigenous Mountain Yard people who were captured during the offensive. One other American, Wayne Finch. Wayne was in better shape than me, took care of me, helped me a lot as we left that camp to start a journey north that ended up eventually in Hanoi. Then two others were two of the Vietnamese officers. One was a young Vietnamese A-1 Sky Raider pilot. Tsang Nguyen, who lives in Phoenix, Arizona today. I owe my life to Tsang. He helped me repeatedly along the way, including once when I collapsed and just could not go any further in a condition that other prisoners who had collapsed and couldn't go any further were shot. Tsang put my arms around his shoulders and drug me through the jungle for the rest of the day until we hit a way station, which I think is the only reason the communists allowed me to survive. The other is Kay Nyum, who lives in San Jose, California today. And there's probably not enough time to go into the stories of Kay and what he did for me, but he certainly helped get me some food and gave me encouragement and helped me repeatedly, and he and I became dear friends as prisoners. And those two friendships with those two Vietnamese continue to this day. They escaped over the years and got into the States. Sadly, the American Wayne Finch did not survive the trip north to Hanoi. He died before he got to Hanoi.
I know how devastating that was to you in the book, the way you describe when you found out about that. How long was the trip from South Vietnam to Hanoi?
Well, when we set out at that camp, I was pulled out of my cage, put with a group of a couple dozen South Vietnamese prisoners and Wayne, the one other American, and we were told that we were going to go on a trip that could take up to 11 days and that we should try very hard to take it. So out of that group of 26, we marched far more than 11 days. The trip ended up taking more than 3 months, and a half dozen of those South Vietnamese prisoners and Wayne died before that trip was complete.
Can you describe to our audience, we're talking with William Reeder, his book is Through the Valley, My Captivity in Vietnam, and I don't want him to go into great detail, because I really want you, the audience, I want you to read this book. It just shows you the inner strength that mankind has, and not only that, but how, you know, men love men and will help them do whatever it is to survive. And as you mentioned, the friends that you made on this journey, I was just amazed at the trip up the trail. Most of us are familiar with the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but this was running through, you know, Cambodia and Laos up into North Vietnam. It was bombed daily, and you're trying to travel up this road. You mentioned in your book, you describe a B-52 strike, and I think our audience would like to know about that.
Yeah, that was the B-52 strike was actually after I got into North Vietnam on the trail, and we're working our way up Route 1, the main highway of North Vietnam, which was, bombed daily in an attempt to obliterate it and stop traffic. But the Vietnamese, after every bombing, would repair and the traffic would continue. And we were moving near the city of Vinh in North Vietnam, and a couple of artillery, anti-aircraft artillery rounds fired, but it was a signal that the Vietnamese used. They'd have two rounds that would fire, and that was an alert that a bombing raid was coming in. And our Vietnamese guards started shouting, Banam Hai, Banam Hai, which is Vietnamese for B-52, B-52. And we were in an area that had been extensively bombed. Our guards placed our group in a crater, all huddled together. The guard next to me pulled out his pistol and held it to my head. I don't know what he thought, if I was going to try to escape during the bombing raid. I guess he did. We always thought of B-52 strikes as destroying everything in the pattern, that nothing survived. This B-52 strike was close to being on top of us. The earth shook like I can't describe. The noise was loud as I can't describe. The pressure was immense. But when it was over, I opened my eyes and looked around. My ears were ringing. There was dirt and dust everywhere. But I was fine, and everyone in our group was fine. And we crawled up out of our crater, very shaken, but continued our march north.
And you got to ride sometimes, too, didn't you?
Yeah, but that was no fun. I walked every foot of the way from Cambodia up up to the border of North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Then they put us on trucks, and my first thought getting on the truck was, oh, thank God, because I just had an agonizing experience every foot of walking that. I said, God, now I'm on a truck. But the truck was jolting. There were no shocks, no springs, I don't think. It was just a hard ride, really hurt my back badly. And then we'd get bomb attacks when we were on the trucks that were very close and very frightening as well.
You got to meet so many famous names that, you know, that those of us who study the Vietnam War or paid any attention to the news at the time. You finally did make it up to Hanoi. You weren't put in Hanoi Hilton originally. You were in another place. What was that called?
A plantation gardens. It was in the city of Hanoi. It was a. It looked like an old plantation house inside this compound. We didn't get to stay in the plantation house. There were some one-story warehouse buildings around it that had been turned into prison cells, and that's where we stayed, in the plantation gardens at first. That camp, when I got there, was all prisoners who had been captured in South Vietnam and in Laos. We stayed there through the beginning of the Christmas bombing campaign when Nixon mm-hmm. unleashed the B-52s on Hanoi in December of 1972. And then in the middle of that bombing campaign, we moved out of there and moved to a new camp, the what turned out to be the Hoa Lo prison, or what is more commonly known to Americans as the Hanoi Hilton. That was my final camp before release.
And can you describe just a little bit? I know there were so many delays in trying to get released, and you know they build up your hopes, and tell me how the North Vietnamese tried to prepare you, all the guys that were there, for their release.
Well, after the war was the peace agreements were signed by the agreements, they had to present the agreements to us, so they read them to us, and we were all supposed to be released within 60 days after the signing of the agreements, and at the end of January, I think it was 60 or 90 days. It was supposed to be by time of capture, so I was going to be in one of the latter release groups. As it turned out, I was in the last release group of those released by the Provisional Revolutionary Government, or the Communist Government of South Vietnam. There's a whole story behind that, but there mm-hmm. were two groups of prisoners in Hanoi, one held by the North Vietnamese, one held by the Viet Cong, supposedly. Actually, all of us were held by North Vietnamese. I was captured by North Vietnamese. At any rate, I was in the last release group of the Viet Cong-held prisoners out of Hanoi. We were supposed to be released on schedule on March the 24th, 1973. That day came. We all got ready to be released. The normal routine that the prisoners went through was they would roll up their sleeping mats. They would march out of the cells. They would be issued new clothing to wear on the airplane flight home, and they would leave the prison, go to the Gia Lam Airport in Hanoi, and fly home. Our day came. We rolled up our bamboo sleeping mat that was just on a board. I mean, that was our bed, was a board with a mat on it, and sat there and sat there and sat there and never got released and didn't know what was going on. Late in the afternoon, the camp commander called us all into the courtyard. Here we are, the last release group, and said, Nixon has done an about-face on the war, on his agreements. The war continues. The war is not ending. It will go on forever, and go back to your cells. And there we sat.
I can't imagine how that would affect you psychologically.
It was tough. It was tough. But 3 days later, something happened, and I think that the U.S. threatened to unleash the B-52s again. And we were taken through that process, put on old ratty buses on the street outside the Hilton, driven to the Gia Lam Airport, where I saw the biggest, most beautiful U.S. Air Force C-141 medical evacuation airplane, the most beautiful I'd seen in my life. We went through a very formal, I'm sure, propaganda release process, turned over to American control, and got on that 141 and flew away from Hanoi and went to the Philippines.
Yeah, what happened when you were out of effective rocket range?
Oh, well, so they put us on the airplane. We're all kind of numb because we'd been through this rigmarole of not being released and wondering what was going on. And so we're sitting there in the airplane, just sitting there. The plane takes off, flies for a little bit, and then finally the pilot comes on the intercom and said, I just wanted to tell you all that we have just gone outside of SAM missile range. And at that instant, the entire plane erupted in a cheer and smiles, so we finally realized we were out of there, and we're going to be going home free. It was amazing.
We've only got about 3 minutes left. It really went fast. Tell me about you arrived in the Philippines and you were told not to eat everything that they gave you, but you did.
Yeah, well, and the poor guys that came out in the first release group, the docs had a plan. They didn't want to upset our system. They knew we hadn't been eating much and nothing very rich. So they had a very bland diet. Well, the initial guys about revolted, and so by the time I got released, they had completely reversed that whole thing, and they had a mess hall dining facility opened up to us with almost anything that you could imagine under the sun to eat. And I don't remember exactly. I had some steak and some Eggs Benedict kind of stuff, and they might even have had some lobster. I'm trying to think back now. But I filled myself to the brim, and I even had a hot fudge sundae for dessert. I went back to my hospital room. I was sicker than a dog and didn't feel well at all, but it was worth every bit of it. I was so happy. I was laying there in my bed sick and with a big smile on my face.
I was going to say, that was the best stomach ache you ever got.
Yeah, that's right.
So you came home and you stayed in the service.
I did. You know, I could have got out with a disability. I was, in fact, I was not medically fit to fly anymore. But I decided to stay in. I had had a good career. I had achieved a lot in the Army, and so I decided to stay. And I'm glad that I did. I think it helped my adjustment. Even though I was medically disqualified from flight, there was a provision in the regulation where, with a waiver from the Surgeon General, you could continue to fly. So I got a waiver from the Army Surgeon General. I had to renew it every year, but I was able to fly for the rest of my career. So I was truly blessed.
You were. You ended up being an instructor, and are you retired now? Well, other than writing.
I retired from the Army in 1995, but I have continued, and then I was doing other things. I wanted to be a college professor in a quiet park-like university atmosphere somewhere. Well, that was all on track. I got a PhD, and then 9/11 hit, after that, I wanted to do something to help, and I went back doing work with the Army again. I have either been a civil servant or defense contractor ever since, teaching largely leadership development. And I continue to do that, though I am on a transition this year to get myself retired. I've gone part-time, hopefully fully retired by 2018.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. We've been talking to William Reeder, Jr. His book is Through the Valley, My Captivity in Vietnam. It's a great read. There are so many heroes in this story. And normally we don't talk about heroes that survive, but I think you guys died and came back again, and I want to thank you so very much for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Dale, and I just hope that my story will be helpful for others who are facing, you know, either PTSD in the Army or challenges in life, but I think that it might. I hope it does.
Well, if you write anything again, let us know. I'd love to have you back on.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. All right, that's our program for today. We will be back next week, and we will be talking veteran stories. That's what we do here. So until then, you are dismissed.